Song, hosted by Dira Sujan.
Hello and welcome to my series of meetings with remarkable people. Today my guest is Professor Deirdre McCluskey, an economist, or more than that, a top-class, internationally renowned economist. She's currently holding the prestigious Tinbergen Chair at Rotterdam's Erasmus University. Author of some 20 publications and rumoured to be a possible candidate for the Nobel Prize, she's also remarkable in that she's one of the very few women in a male-dominated field. But what's unique about her is that until this year, Deirdre McCluskey was not in the minority in this academic world of men. That is to say, she was known as Donald McCluskey, respected professor, author, and father of two children. But at the age of 53, Professor McCluskey decided to be true to the person he'd felt all his life and crossed genders. The courage of the decision doesn't need to be elaborated on. When one has made such a name for oneself in a top academic field, appearing suddenly at conferences and international seminars as someone of the opposite sex must need a strong set of teeth to take the bit between. But Professor McCluskey's teeth are not the only strong thing about her, as I found out. But first of all, I wanted to know why it took her so long to take the plunge she must have craved all her life.
Well, that's actually a quite common pattern. You'll find that quite a few transsexuals agonize about it, they suppress it, they hide it in one part of their personality. And after all, it's not uncommon for people to change their way of life this late in life. There's the sort of cliche psychology of the midlife crisis, and you could, if you wanted, you could speak in that terms about this.
So what made you finally decide to do it?
Well, exploring it, finding out about it. I had explored it to some degree earlier in my life, but essentially through the internet I discovered a lot more about transvestism, which is cross-dressing, which is actually fairly common, and transsexuality, which is very rare. And after many months of thought and reading and email correspondence and internet finding out, I came to the realization that what my cross-dressing had been about was transsexuality, so to speak. It had been about it, and I had suppressed this, but that's what it was about.
Was coming to Holland one of the things that made it a good time to do it?
Holland is a very good place to transition. It's a joke that there are lots of tall people in Holland, but it's also true, and it's very helpful to a person my height. I'm not the tallest woman on the street, hardly ever. I did not come here to take advantage of the Dutch taxpayers, and I am not an official patient in the famous transsexuality program at the Free University of Amsterdam. Holland is a tolerant place to do this, but it's not perfectly free. It's free in the sense of allowed. There's an awful lot of what I think is unreasonable conservatism in the treatment of transsexuals around the world. For some reason, people believe, society believes, that it has the right to intervene in this very personal decision. It's analogous, actually, to the on a much smaller scale, it's analogous to the abortion controversy.
Tell me a little bit about how it's affected you. You move in academic circles, educated people, one would think liberal, tolerant people. How have your colleagues accepted you?
They've accepted me very well. I've been surprised by this. I think it's because I'm a senior, established figure. I'm 53. I'm not 23. It would be much harder, I think, and they would be much harsher if I was a 23-year-old graduate student instead of a 53-year-old full professor.
Why?
Well, because I have a standing in the field. I've published a lot. People sort of think they know who I am, and they don't want to throw away that person who they know out of some fear of their own about transsexuality, so they're able to handle it. Put it this way, if I wasn't useful to people, they might not be so pleasant. But in any case, that's an uncharitable interpretation. I think a great deal of the ease with which this has gone is simply that it's not as much of a problem for people as you might think. I mean, my view of it is, one less man in the world, one more woman. Good idea.
And I know a lot of people who would second that motion. But, you know, you mentioned that it was easier for your colleagues to accept it because of your age, but I would have thought that for you, it would have been easier to do it when you were younger.
It's easier biologically at age 23 because you can do a more thorough change with the hormones of your body. But it's much harder emotionally because at age 53, most people have a fairly clear idea of who they are. Now, in one important way, I did not. It took me until age 53 to be absolutely clear about this. But on the other hand, in lots of other ways, I know my limitations, I know my skills, I know my emotions much better than I did at age 23. So, from a psychological point of view, it's easier at age 53. And from a financial point of view, it's a lot easier because I think people get the impression that all this is sort of on the National Health Service or something. It's not. My joke about it is that this costs about as much as a fairly fancy Mercedes, and I'd rather walk.
And as we all know, this is the time of life when men have to buy those expensive fast cars, isn't it?
Boy, do they. In fact, that's right. You can have a midlife crisis by spending $50,000 on an automobile or $50,000 on a sex change. I much prefer the sex change.
When did you know? When did you know that it wasn't quite right before?
Well, I've known it since I was 11. I've always been interested in transsexuality. That's always been part of my cross-dressing, thinking about it. But I didn't think it was practical. I didn't think a large man like me could accomplish it. I can remember the very day when I started cross-dressing, that is, dressing in women's clothes. Always privately, always confidentially. The only person who ever knew about this was my wife of 30 years. And from that day, I've had thoughts about transsexuality.
You talk about your wife knowing. You had two children as well. How has it affected your family?
Well, parts of my family, it's been fine. My mother is going to come to my oration. It's the inaugural address for a chair. But it's been very hard on my son, and I think it's been very hard, although I can't tell for sure, on my grown daughter. And it's been extremely hard on my former wife. They haven't adjusted to it, but it hasn't been long after all. And I hope that in the longer run, I hope we can get back to love, put it that way.
You've said that having this change, this sex change, has made you a different kind of economist. It's affected the way you view your work. How?
Well, in the first place, it's made me more aware that society depends on love. Now, this may strike you as a kind of an obvious point, and it is. But it's more obvious to women than it is to men. I mean, it's possible for men to pretend, as they do in mainstream economics, that there is no love in the world, that the world is composed entirely of wholly selfish people, and that no one cares about family or country or friends. Now, I admit this is a somewhat incredible way of looking at the world, but it's been very powerful and successful intellectually in economics. Now I think there's something strange about it. There's something screwy about this way of looking at the world. I haven't been thinking about this terribly long. Bear that in mind. I haven't got these ideas fully worked out. What I do know is that a theory even of selfishness that doesn't account for people's desire to be parts of groups has got something wrong with it. Aristotle, the great philosopher, emphasized that human beings are political animals. And what he meant by that is that they're citizens or members of families or within circles of friends, and they really like it. It's part of being human to want to be thought of as a member of a group and a respected member of a group, and to be worthy of it. And this is a point about, so to speak, social psychology that economics has ignored for a long, long time.
So you're saying that now that you've gone from being a man to a woman, you're thinking about this sort of stuff more because yes. Women are more caring, sharing creatures.
Yes, that's exactly it. I've been astounded at the quality of female friendship. It's something that is very different from the way most men who call themselves friends interact. And even in superficials, the way women behave with each other is not the same as men. If you sit down beside another woman in a public place, she'll smile at you. She's essentially conveying permission for you to sit down close to her, and she's welcoming you to her community. And she'll speak to you sometimes, and you'll have a small conversation which establishes solidarity. None of that happens with men. They do not smile at each other. They are always in competition. They aren't interested in forming communities. They're interested in competing. So there's a whole other way of being in the world that I've been opened up to.
But you've also talked about feeling like a woman for most of your life since you were a kid, that you felt female inside, and basically what you've just done here is just fixed it physically. Why is it so different?
I wouldn't quite say that. I would say that I didn't feel like a woman inside. I felt that I wanted to be one. I felt that very strongly. But I put it this way. I'm not sure there is an inside. I think we are pretty much the roles we play. If you think about it, we're parents, or we're children, or we're workers of this kind or another. And there isn't any inside to talk about. I was a successful man. I was a macho man. I was aggressive and assertive in the prescribed way for men, especially for American men. I was an obedient child. They told me to go play football, so I played football. So I didn't feel like a girl. I just felt that would be a nice thing to be. Not that would be a good thing to be, that that was appropriate for me. But I did not explore it very much. And it's only in exploring it over the last year that I've come to understand that it really does deeply suit me. I mean, there's sort of a paradox in what I say, because on the one hand I say there isn't any inside. On the other hand, I say it suits me. I don't know how to answer this. I don't know what to say about that paradox.
Does that mean that inside we're all the same and we really just adapt to what our outer bodies tell us or tell the world we are?
In a lot of ways. Or one could say there's kind of an empty center. There's nothing there for us all. And then we're imprinted on, or we make ourselves with our habits, with our social roles, with the various small decisions we make about how to behave. I mean, for example, just to be more concrete than this very abstract way of talking, I've, since November 23rd, I've lived full-time as a woman, which means that I wear female clothes. I don't have any male clothes. I haven't had any for a long time. I accidentally purchased a jacket with the buttons on the wrong side, and I don't want to wear it. So here I am, choosing every day to put on female clothes. They finally feel like my own clothes. And with this habit, which is fairly superficial, I mean, buttons on the left instead of the right, what does it matter? That helps you feel and act the role. It's like putting on a uniform. A soldier puts on a uniform. It makes him feel more soldierly.
You talked about when you were a man, you were macho and aggressive and you did all the right things that society expected from you. Did you have to unlearn how to be a man at the same time you were learning how to be a woman then?
Absolutely. Although some of the things came surprisingly naturally. I was in my house on Halloween, which is an American holiday, where the children get dressed up and go around and ask for candy. And I was alone in the house. I was in male clothes. And these three children came to the door with their father. And I found myself going nuts over these children. I felt I just loved them. They were so cute. They were just cute. I wanted the father to go away. I wanted to adopt the children on the spot. I wanted to mother them. They were wonderful. Now, that surprised me. I was quite startled by the strength of my feelings. And I don't know if it was the hormones, which I had been on for a couple of months at that point, or whether it was just the release of the person I wanted to be. But in any case, I didn't have any trouble learning how to be motherly and unlearning the more remote behavior of the father. I'm now, with children, extremely motherly and unfatherly. So some of the things are easy, some are hard.
Surely you had fatherly, you have your own children. You must have felt the same kind of responses to your own kids when they were small.
No.
But in a different way, no?
In a completely different way. And that was what's so shocking about it. I was a attentive, skilled, and loving father, I think. Not perfect. Boy, I've seen some of my imperfection as a parent. I've come to understand that. But I was a father, and I acted like a father, and now I act like a mother, at least much, much more so than before. There are some things that are hard, though. I mean, matters of gesture. The hardest thing is speech. I mean, I still have a male voice. With exercise, over a long period, over many, many, many months, one can acquire a reasonably passable female voice. The male instrument is larger, that's all. So you have to learn to only use part of the instrument. So there are hard things and easy things, and I'm surprised at how many things are easy.
Most of the world's leading economists are men. Do you think the world would be a different place if it was 50-50 at least, if there were 50% female?
Well, I've tried to change it, but I've tried to change that ratio, but I admit it's a kind of a radical way of changing it. Yeah, I think economics is a male field, and this fear of love and this fleeing from the fact of love in the world is an example. I don't want people to get the impression that I want an economics that doesn't have any selfishness in it. I don't think that would be a very intelligent economics either. But economics would radically change if it was 50-50. It's something I'm going to try to contribute to in more ways than changing my own gender.
In what ways, then?
Well, trying to encourage female graduate students, because that's how you make professors.
So we've been talking about something that I know I've been in many arguments about over here, about women being the caring and sharing type and men being the macho aggressors of this world. And it's just an argument now that's sort of not as strong as it was, say, in the 60s and 70s, and the world is a changing place. How do you account for the Mrs. Thatcher phenomena? You know, if we had 50% of the world's future female economists, what if they were like Mrs. Thatcher? Would there be a difference?
Well, she and I agree on a lot of things. I'm a free market, conservative Chicago School economist, and I think a lot of the things that Margaret Thatcher accomplished are just fine. But it's an interesting fact about Margaret Thatcher is that she had very few women in her cabinet. She didn't think it an important part of her agenda to encourage other women, which I think is a shame. And that's the only fault I can see in Margaret Thatcher.
You think that she had a caring and sharing regime?
No, she had a... Okay, it's not the only fault I can see in Margaret Thatcher. The other fault I can see in Margaret Thatcher is that she fundamentally misunderstands capitalism. It's only a small fault. She thinks of capitalism in what I would describe in American terms as country club republicanism. That is, I've got mine, Jack, to hell with you. And I don't think that's how capitalism actually operates. I mean, that's what I think is wrong with an economics that ignores solidarity and love. You don't run a successful firm without love, put it that way.
Sony, Philips, I mean, what place does love have in multinationals and the way they do their business?
Well, if you actually are inside a multinational, what you'll find is that in each part of it, there's a kind of a family. There's a kind of a solidarity or love or affection between the people on the job. There's a view of capitalism that says, well, if we move to a market society, we won't have any occasions for solidarity and love. But on the contrary, the more you're in corporations and other enterprises in the marketplace, the more places there are for conversing, for making friends, for becoming acquainted with all kinds of different people, for expanding one's view of what the human condition is. They couldn't function without that social glue.
What drove you to becoming an economist?
Well, what drives quite a few people, I wanted to save the world. Economics is sort of a practical way of helping people, suppose. At least that's what I thought as an undergraduate. I've also come to understand that I became an economist because it was a very macho thing. And I've spent a lot of my career unconsciously hiding the fact that I want to be a woman.
So 20, 30 years down the road, do you feel that you have managed to save the world with those earlier dreams by becoming an economist? Do you believe that you can save the world?
On the contrary, I believe that attempts to save the world are very hazardous to our health, very hazardous to the world. I think this is something that a lot of economists come to. Certainly a lot of economists of my generation, which after all is the Vietnam generation, came to understand that social engineering doesn't work, that trying to lay down the future, trying to make everything predictable, and trying to achieve certitude in society doesn't work.
You've been named as a possible candidate for a Nobel Prize. Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
My main thought is that it would be delightful to be presented to the King and Queen of Sweden in an evening gown. That's my main thought about it, I must say. Well, it's a little facetious, but here's something I feel very uncomfortable about. I feel very uncomfortable being the first woman. Scandalously, they didn't give the prize to Joan Robinson, who ought to have gotten the Nobel Prize.
You're a woman now, you felt like a woman all your life, but still you don't feel that you deserve to win in the category as a woman.
Yeah, maybe I'll feel more comfortable about it in a few years, but here's something that I do feel about this. I've seen so many male economists, elderly male economists, ruin their old age by dreaming about the Nobel Prize. I don't want to do that. I'm a woman now. I'm not an obsessed, monomaniacal man. I can handle it if I don't get the Nobel Prize. The men I'm thinking of, and I'm thinking of quite a few of them, can't. They think about it day and night. They campaign. They spend all their vacations in Sweden. They learn Swedish. I'm not making this up. They get introduced to every Swedish and Norwegian economist they can find. I think that's childishly male, and I'm not going to do it.
And this is a really corny question, but yeah. Do you have any regrets?
No, not at all. I've made decisions, we all have, that haven't been 100% decisions that one's not sure of afterwards. Well, was that the right person to marry, say, or was that the correct job to choose? That sort of thing. One can't be sure in life. But I'm amazed. Since I've come to this understanding of myself, I've had 3 minutes of doubt. I mean, and that's not very strong. I mean, I don't know if it's amounted to 3 minutes in total. I have been so pleased with this. Almost all transsexuals have no regrets at all. And if they do, they can start taking male hormones. And in a few months, they'll start acting like a jerk again.
Do you regret that you didn't do it sooner?
Oh, I got mixed feelings about that. Some things, as I said, would be biologically easier if I'd done it earlier. On the other hand, I had a very pleasant, successful, not unhappy life as a man. I had a 30-year, very successful marriage and a couple of fine children. And I don't know. I think this is as appropriate a time as any. Anyway, I'm going to enjoy the next, I hope, 30 years of my life very much as an old lady, if you want to put it that way.
A gracious and elegant old lady, though. That was Professor of Economics Deirdre McCluskey. Next week, concluding our series of program-length interviews, my very special guest is one of the greatest violinists of our century. He was a child prodigy and has been in the world's eye since he was 7 years old. He recently celebrated his 80th birthday, and in his extraordinary life, he's been a world figure not only because of his musical gifts, but also for his humanitarian ideals and causes. He's met most of the century's political leaders during his personal crusade of trying to use music to heal the ills of the world. His lifetime has spanned playing with Edward Elgar to the very young Nigel Kennedy. I hope you'll join me next week when I'll be in conversation with Lord Yehudi Menuhin. But for now, from technician William Pongers and me, Dira Sujan, it's goodbye.